We saw last week that 70 administrators were to be appointed in Israel to assist Moses in the government of the country. Well, if you're going to have administrators, you must have a law to administer. And in chapters 20 to 23, the first batch of those laws are given to us. They're in two sections. Firstly, you have the basic principles in the form of the Ten Commandments. And then you have some of the laws which were based on those principles. For example, you have the principle, you shall not steal. And then later on you get various laws that arose as cases of stealing came before people. And what do you do in such and such a case of malicious damage to property or things disappearing in mysterious circumstances? And so these other laws grow up. The absolute laws, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, these types of laws were unique to Israel in the ancient world. The other types of laws were fairly common in people of that region, the various case studies that arose. Now I'm going to look this morning more at this second category. I think we are reasonably familiar with the Ten Commandments. We're not so familiar with many of these laws that arise out of them, and I want to concentrate on those this morning. But before doing so, four features I'd like to point out concerning Israelite law. Firstly, these laws that we're going to look at. They were designed to suit the social habits of the time. They were designed to administer justice within a community whose way of life was already established. In other words, the laws are not painting for us the picture of an ideal society. They are not idealistic, they are down to earth. For example, slavery existed there, bigamy existed. And what these laws are doing is seeking to get some order into the chaos that was there. And so you'll find laws about slavery, you'll find laws that presuppose bigamy. We can't go to these laws to justify slavery or to justify bigamy or some of these other oddities you meet along the way. Because that's not what the laws are designed to do. They're not designed to paint the picture of an ideal society. They're designed to get some order into a society whose way of life was already well established and whose habits were bad. So bit by bit, they are to be reformed and transformed and educated. And as you move on, you find that the laws that are given here are the first steps towards the eradication of some of these evils. The second point I'd like to mention is that in these laws you'll find the punishment fits the crime. In other words, you don't have excessive punishments for minor offences. You don't have light punishments for major offences. You find it here in chapter 21, those well-known words in verses 23 to 25. You have an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, a stripe for a stripe. In other words, if you have a major offence, you have a major punishment. If you have a light offence, you have a light punishment. You don't take a person's eye out because he bruised somebody. It's a bruise for a bruise. It's an eye for an eye. And Jesus did not abrogate this when he gave his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, when he said that we are to be forgiving. Jesus was not giving instruction for magistrates. Jesus was giving instruction to his disciples. And we as his disciples are not to be motivated by an attitude of tit for tat. We are to be forgiving. But here Moses is giving instruction to magistrates. And the basis of justice is that you must have an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and a hand for a hand or a foot for a foot. You must have a punishment that is proportionate to the crime that is committed. And Romans 13, of course, develops this well. It is the function of law to return evil for evil. It's the whole point of punishment and justice being carried out. And what the law here is saying is that the punishment must be proportionate to the crime. And in many of those ancient societies, the punishments were out of all proportion to the crimes committed. Horrendous punishments sometimes for fairly minor offences. You don't find that in Israelite law. It stands out for its justice. That's the second point. The third point is the protection it gave for the disadvantaged people in the society. They didn't have government welfare schemes in those days. And people such as aliens, minority groups, widows, orphans, these were fair game for the unscrupulous. The law of Israel takes particular note of these people and protects them from exploitation at the hands of those who are out for themselves. You'll find that in chapter 22, for example, verses 21 to 24. It mentions the strangers, that's the aliens in Israel. It mentions in verse 22 the orphans and the widows, and it goes on to say how God has a special care for these people. So that's another feature of Israelite law. And the fourth feature is that there is equal justice for all. The laws were not framed to suit the ruling classes. Now, we in Australia are in the minority in that our system of justice is good. In the majority of countries in the world today, if you are not one of the upper classes, if you are one of the poorer, disadvantaged classes, you have no way of obtaining elementary justice, because the whole system is stacked in favour of the haves as against the have-nots. Now, you find that Israelite law stood out in contrast to most of the other law systems of the day, in that it gave equal justice for all, regardless of status or class. You'll find it in chapter 23, verse 6. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his suit. You shall not pervert the justice due to the poor. Now, sometimes you get a reaction in the opposite direction. Sometimes because they're being careful not to pervert the justice due to the poor, they sometimes pervert the justice that's due to the rich. So you get a swing in the opposite extreme. Well, you find that the Israelite law gives advice against that as well. In chapter 23, verse 3, it says, you shall not be partial to a poor man. So you shan't be partial against a poor man, but neither should you be partial to a poor man. And this, again, was unique in the ancient world and indeed in the modern world in many countries today, this even-handed justice. And while we're on chapter 23, look at verses 4 and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the ass of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall help him to lift it up. Never let us get the idea that the Israelite law encouraged vindictiveness. Just the opposite. You find it there, right in the middle of these laws in Exodus. You're to love your enemy and you're to do good to the person who hates you. And that's a gross misunderstanding of the law of Israel that some people have. They think it encouraged vindictiveness. Nothing of the sort. The commandment, love your neighbour as yourself, was not original to Jesus. It's there in the law of Moses, Leviticus of all places, where it says in Leviticus chapter 19, you shall love your neighbour as yourself, you shall not even bear a grudge against your neighbour, you shall not hate him in your heart. And what Jesus was talking against in the opening chapters of Matthew was not the law of Moses, but the false interpretations of the law of Moses, which were being peddled around by the scribes, Pharisees, and others of his day. All right, I now want to move on and to look largely at two areas of this section. Miscellaneous laws covering all sorts of things here. I want to look at two things. Firstly, slavery, and secondly, goods or possessions. Chapter 21 talks about slavery. Here we find the first steps towards the emancipation of slaves. The first thing the Israelite law does is to say that no person can be held a slave for more than 6 years. Now that is an advance far ahead of its age. In the seventh year, all slaves were to be freed, and that applied to female as well as male, which is another advance on the thinking of the day. It doesn't say so here in Exodus, but if you read the parallel passage in Deuteronomy, you'll find that the female slaves are freed in the seventh year, the same as the male slaves. And in the opening six verses of chapter 21, you find that that is spelt out there. Then from verse 7 through to 11, it considers the special case of a female slave who had become the concubine of her master. This is a special case that talks about here. Verse 7. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do, but only in this case of a concubine, because you'll find, as I said in Deuteronomy, she does go out as the male slaves do. But here Moses is thinking of this case of the master who has cast his lustful eyes on this beauty and has decided he'll make her his concubine. If in verse 8 he finds that she doesn't live up to expectations, or she's a bit of a handful, she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. That is, she can be bought back by her father or by some other eligible husband, if you like, somebody who can buy her from him. But he shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people. Just can't dispose of her like goods and chattels. She has her rights and she's to be treated as a wife. He's dealt faithlessly with her and he's got to handle the situation properly. Verse 10. If he takes another wife to himself, then he shall not diminish the first wife's food, clothing, or marital rights. And if he doesn't do these three things for her, then he shall let her go out for nothing without payment of money. Now you can see here how the rights of the woman are protected. As I've said, we are taking a situation in a community where we have an evil that already exists, but the laws are laid down which firstly control the evil, and then as further laws are introduced, once they're followed through, you'll find they would lead eventually to the eradication of the evil. Now, a few other points here about slaves. You'll notice if you go down to verse 16 that people were not allowed to kidnap others and make them slaves. Anybody who steals a man, whether he sells him or keeps him for himself, shall be put to death. No slave trading was allowed in Israel whatever. Now, how do people become slaves? Well, immediately you've eliminated the major cause of slavery. The main reason people became slaves was that they sold themselves into slavery in payment for debts, or if they had stolen property and couldn't repay what they had stolen, so they had to work it off in forms of labour. But no kidnapping was allowed, verse 16. Notice also as you go down to verse 20, the master was not allowed to treat his slaves as he wished. There was no violence allowed. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, then the master is punished. Now, we're not told how he was punished, but I would think, in keeping with something we'll see in a few moments' time, I would think he is punished the same as anybody else is punished who is responsible for the death of another. Capital punishment. Verse 21, if, however, the slave survives a day or two, he gets a beating but he doesn't die immediately, well, then the master is not punished, for the slave is his money. You read that and you think, well, that's a bit rough. Can he just treat the slave as he likes because he owns the slave? But that's not the point of it. Here we have this principle that a person's innocent until he's proved guilty. And we have this fundamental clause built in that you give a person the benefit of the doubt. Now, if the slave, as in verse 21, dies under his master's hand, obviously he's died from the beating. If he survives a few days, there's an element of doubt. Has he died from the beating, or has he died from some other cause? Would he have died anyway? So, in this case, the owner doesn't suffer the penalty of capital punishment, but neither can he replace the slave. He's lost his money, he's lost his slave. As we'd say in raw Australian, he's done his dough. The slave's his money, you see. He's finished with him, he's lost him, and he can't replace him. So there's the element of fine and punishment there. On the other hand, he is given the benefit of the doubt. The justice of the thing is very impressive. You go on in verses 22 following, where we see what I've just mentioned about the punishment fitting the crime. You go down to verse 26, and you find that if the master is violent and he strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, then he must let the slave go free. Even if he knocks out a tooth, he has to let the slave go free for the sake of the tooth. When you come to verse 28, we have another set of circumstances here. It doesn't start talking about slaves immediately. It'll get onto that in a moment. It talks here about an ox which gores a man or a woman to death. Then the ox shall be stoned, its flesh shall not be eaten. This is a recognition of the sanctity of human life. The ox gores a man to death, the ox is killed in recognition of the sanctity of human life. But the owner shall be clear, except, in verse 29, if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned, but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, then the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. So the man then is held responsible, and he is put to death, again, in recognition of this sanctity of human life. Now, as you move down, you come to verse 30, and you find that if a ransom is laid upon the man, well, then he can buy his life back again by a payment made to the relatives of the dead man. So he can redeem his life by payment of cash instead. But the point I'm getting at is in verse 32, that if the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to the master 30 shekels of silver, that's payment for the slave, and the ox shall be stoned. Exactly the same treatment applies. His life is just as sacred in God's eyes as the life of a free man, and the ox who kills a slave is treated in exactly the same way as an ox who kills anybody else. And so this immediately again sets the Israelite law apart from all the other laws which looked upon slaves as mere chattels, as things. You could follow this through in the New Testament if you wished, and you could look at some of the references to slavery there, and you could see some of the good points concerning masters and slaves. I'm not going to develop that now, but you could think of the references concerning ourselves. We have been bought with a price. We're God's. Therefore, we are not to be the servants of men. We have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body, says the apostle. And so you can follow through the good aspects. You can also follow through the evil aspects, if you like, of slavery. And you get these developed, for example, in Romans 6, where it talks about the old sinful nature as being a tyrant, a slave master, and we are not to become slaves of that old sinful nature. But we will if we give it a chance. Before we leave chapter 21, look at those final few verses. The justice of this I find fascinating. When a man leaves a pit open, or when he digs a pit and doesn't cover it, and an ox or an ass falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to the owner of the dead animal, but the dead beast shall be his. So he has to pay the person full price of the animal who's fallen into his pit, but he can at least keep the carcass of the dead beast, and he can use its hide for whatever he wants to do, so that the other person gets fully compensated, and that he himself at least has this dead animal, because he didn't deliberately set about to trap the other man's animal, so there's a slight compensation for him. Verse 35, when one man's ox hurts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the price 50-50. The dead beast also they shall divide 50-50. The fairness of this is very commendable, isn't it? Except in verse 36, that if the ox has been known to gore in the past and the owner has not kept it in, then he shall pay the full price, ox for ox. But again, he can keep the dead beast, use it for cat meat or whatever he wants to do with it. But this justice and fairness. Now, once again, you hear people making rude comments about the Israelite law, and sometimes you'll hear Christians speaking as if somehow the Israelite law was second rate, and we in Christianity have reached a much higher level than those Jews ever had reached. Well, I'm not so sure. When I look at some Christians, I think that there's a lot we can learn from this. There's an honesty, there's a fairness here that you sometimes don't find among Christians. We may not be under the law, but remember the words of the apostle. What? Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? God forbid. I trust we're not put to shame as we compare ourselves with these people of former days and what was required of them. The justice and fairness is exemplary. You come to chapter 22, and here we have the matter of possessions or goods. I've divided these into four categories, and I've called them stolen goods, deposited goods, borrowed goods, and hired goods. Firstly, stolen goods. If the thief was caught, well then restitution had to be made, and in fact two or three or even four times the amount had to be paid back to the person whose goods had been stolen. Fair enough. Interesting verse in verses 2 and 3. If a thief is found breaking in, he's caught in the act, and he is struck so that he dies, then there shall be no blood guilt upon the person who struck him. But if the sun has risen, then there shall be blood guilt upon him. And what's the point of that? The point is that normally they had to arrest the wrongdoer and hand him over to the magistrates for proper treatment. If it was at night, well, there's an element of risk there, and the person may have to protect himself. Who knows what's happening in the dark? So if he catches a thief and it's in dark and he manages to kill the thief in the process, well, then there's no guilt upon him. But if it was in broad daylight, there's no excuse. In other words, you can't take the law into your own hands. You can arrest the person and hand him over to the proper authorities and let them deal with him. So much for stolen goods. Verses 7 to 13 deals with deposited goods. Now by that I mean a situation where I come to you and I ask you to look after some of my goods for me. Maybe I'm going away or doing something and I want you to take care of my goods. Now I'm asking the favour of you. So if anything goes wrong with those goods, in the general run of things, I bear the loss, because I'm asking the favour of you. But of course there may be some situations arise where there's an element of doubt. Maybe there's been a little bit of hanky-panky going on and we're not quite sure whether the goods have really been lost. Maybe the chap stole them and pocketed the money. So sometimes difficulties can arise. Now this section 7 to 13 deals with those cases. If a man delivers to his neighbour, verse 7, money or goods to keep, that is to look after for him, and it is stolen out of the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. Well, that's in keeping with previous laws. But if the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbour's goods. Must come and declare on oath that he hath not stolen the goods. No evidence, you have to accept the man's statement on oath that he has not been up to any skullduggery. Supposing, however, you have a case like this, that I leave my ox with you to look after while I go away to some other part of the country, and I come back 2 months later and you give my ox back, And I say, man, he really is pretty skinny looking. I'm sure that's not the ox I left with you. Oh yeah, that's your ox all right. And then I spy another one over there. And I said, that's mine over there with the black marking on its ear or something like this. Oh no, he says, this is it, this is yours here. And I say, no, that's mine over there. So there's a dispute. Who's right? Well, verse 9 tells us that when you have the situation arising, you've got a breach of trust, whether it is for ox, ass, sheep, clothing or anything else, and one of the people says, this is it, he makes a claim to it and somebody else disputes the claim, the case of both parties shall come before the Lord, and him whom God shall condemn shall pay double to his neighbour. So whatever the outcome of the case was, the person who has proved guilty again has to not only recompense but pay double to the person whom he was trying to cheat. Verse 10, if a man delivers to his neighbour an ass, ox, sheep or something else, and it is hurt or it is driven away without anybody seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them to see whether he has not put his hand to his neighbour's property, and the owner shall accept the oath and shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen, then he shall make restitution, if he's stolen it according to the previous laws. If it is torn by beasts, in verse 13, well then let him bring as evidence the remnants of the animal just to prove that it has been attacked, and then he doesn't have to make restitution either. So the general principle there in these deposited goods is that the person who's looking after the goods on behalf of the other person doesn't have to pay if something goes wrong while those goods are in his possession, because the owner has really asked the favour of him. But supposing the boot's on the other foot, supposing you come to me and you want to borrow my goods or my ox to use for yourself, and anything goes wrong, well then you pay, because you're the one that wants the favour in this case. That's the next category you find in verse 14. If a man borrows anything of his neighbour and it is hurt or dies, the owner not being with it, then he shall make full restitution. Which brings us now to the final category, and that is hired goods. Supposing you come again and want to use my ox, and I go with the ox to supervise it and to work it, and anything goes wrong, well, I can't blame you really, because I was with the thing, so I have to accept responsibility. But supposing you hire it from me and I charge you a fee and anything goes wrong, well then you don't have to make restitution, because I should have allowed for those sorts of possibilities when I was calculating the fee in the first place. So in verse 15 it says, if the owner was with the animal, he shall not make restitution, but if it was hired, it came with its hire. It's included in the overall price. So here we have these four categories showing how, when different situations arise with disputes between people, how the magistrates were to handle it. And the point that strikes me is all these complications arise over property, over possessions, and things haven't changed much over several thousand years, because it appears that the majority of disputes and fights and squabbles in societies, in families, in business, in whatever, again, is over this whole subject of material things. It is a problem, and once it gets out of control, it leads to other problems. It's a very hard thing to handle, material prosperity. And when Jesus himself said that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Every one of us has to keep a check on this whole area of financial management, our attitude to prosperity, to property, because therein lies the bulk of our problems. One thing gets out of hand, we develop a certain lifestyle, and because we develop that lifestyle, then we need more cash to keep it going. And so then we need another income. And so this may then have some detrimental effect on, say, our family life. And then we have to be about something else, doing something else. And then maybe we're having an effect on some other person who may need the job more than I do. And so it goes on to the community. Once it gets out of control, it not only affects ourselves and our family, it affects others. And so it goes on and so it goes on. Here we have illustrations in Old Testament times of how it could create social problems. It's still the same today. And Jesus gave some very, very strict teaching about our attitude to prosperity, to wealth, to money. He said, you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon. You can serve one, or you can serve the other, but you can't serve both. So much for the treatment of property. Now, the remainder of chapter 22 goes on to talk about a number of miscellaneous laws. I have no time to discuss them now. It talks about superstitious practices which existed. It talks about lending money to the poor, and how in verses 25 to 27 people were not to take interest if they lent to the poor. has nothing to do with a modern industrialized society where we put money in a bank or a building society. The bank or building society should pay us interest if they want to use our money to make profits for themselves. This is not talking about that. This is talking about exploiting a person who is in need. And so if your brother becomes poor beside you, you help him. You don't say, here's a chance, he can't help himself now and I can put the screws on with some heavy interest and make some money for myself out of this poor chap. What they're encouraging is consideration. And that's the context of that statement there in verses 25 to 27 concerning interest. It goes on through the remainder of the chapter into chapter 23 and discusses some of the matters I talked about before, such as honesty and justice. You come to verses 10 to 13 of chapter 23, and it talks about how the land was to have rest 1 year in seven. People and animals were to have rest 1 day in seven. The land was to have rest 1 year in seven, so that its powers of reproduction might be replenished. These laws are all developed further when you come to Leviticus. Likewise, verses 14 to 17, it talks about the three great annual festivals. At the beginning of the first half of the year, you had the Passover and unleavened bread, and then 6 weeks later, you had the Feast of Harvest or Pentecost. And then at the beginning of the second half of the year, you had the second festival season, initiated with blowing of trumpets and the Day of Atonement, and then the Festival of Shelters or the Festival of Ingatherings. And they're mentioned there in verses 14 to 17 and once again are developed in Leviticus chapter 23. Then after one or two more minor laws about miscellaneous things, chapter 23 concludes with a statement of the underlying principle on which God was operating with his people. And that was, obedience to my laws will bring blessing, disobedience will bring cursing. In chapter 24, we looked at last week very briefly, this was the enactment of the covenant. And these laws that we've just read in chapters 21 to 23 are called the Book of the Covenant. And that was the book that I read about last week in chapter 24, which was sprinkled with the blood. As the people were bound together with God, swearing loyalty to his covenant, they were going to keep his laws. And so you have the blood ritual there as the covenant is sealed. Having completed this, Moses then returned to the mountain. Aaron and Hur were left in charge of the people, and Moses went up into the mountain once again. This time, chapter 24, verse 18 tells us he was there about 6 weeks, and during that time he received the instructions concerning the tabernacle and the priesthood, and we'll look at that next week.